worried Bing. They meant something. They were important. A scarred, scrawny, junky-looking lady had brought those papers and tried to force them on McQueen. Bing had watched the whole thing from behind the curtain in the front room. Victoria McQueen didn't like the junky lady. She yelled at her and made ugly faces. She threw the papers back at her. Their voices had carried, not well, but well enough for Bing to hear one of them say, "Manx." Bing had wanted to wake Mr. Manx up, but you couldn't wake him up when he was like he was. "Because he isn't really asleep," Bing thought, then shoved the unhappy notion aside. He had been in the bedroom once to look at Mr. Manx, lying on top of the sheets wearing nothing but boxer shorts. A great Y was cut into his chest and held shut with coarse black thread. It was partially healed but seeped pus and pink blood, was a glistening canyon in his flesh. Bing had stood listening for minutes but did not hear him breathe once. Mr. Manx's mouth lolled open, exuding the slightly cloying, slightly chemical odor of formaldehyde. His eyes were open, too, dull, empty, staring at the ceiling. Bing had crept close to touch the old man's hand, and it had been cold and stiff as that of any corpse, and Bing had been gripped with the sickening certainty that Mr. Manx was gone. But then Manx's eyes had moved, just slightly, turning to fix on Bing, to stare at him without recognition, and Bing had retreated. Now that the crisis was past, Bing let his shaky, weak legs carry him back to the living room. He stripped off his gas mask and sat down with Mr. and Mrs. DeZote to watch TV with them, needed some time to recover himself. He held old Mrs. DeZote's hand. He watched game shows and now and then checked the street, keeping an eye on the McQueen place. A little before 7, he heard voices and a door banged shut. He returned to the front door and watched from the spy hole. The sky was a pale shade of nectarine, and the boy and his grotesquely fat father were wandering across the yard to the rent-a-car. "We're at the hotel if you need us," Carmody called to Victoria McQueen, who stood on the steps of the house. Bing didn't like the idea of the boy leaving with the father. The boy and the woman belonged together. Manx wanted them both. And so did Bing. The boy was for Manx, but the woman was Bing's treat, someone he could have some fun with in the house of sleep. Just looking at her thin, bare legs made his mouth dry. One last bit of fun in the house of sleep, and then it was on to Christmasland with Mr. Manx, on to Christmasland forever and ever. But no, there was no reason to get in a sweat. Bing had looked at all the mail in Victoria McQueen's mailbox and had found a bill for a day camp in New Hampshire. The kid was registered there through August. It was true. Bing was probably a few clowns short of the full circus, but he didn't think anyone was going to sign their kid up for a camp that cost $800 a week and then just decide to blow it off. Tomorrow was the 4th of July. The father was probably just here to see the child for the holiday. The father and the son drove away, leaving behind the unholy ghost of Victoria McQueen. The papers under the car, the ones that Bing wanted so badly to see, were grabbed by the Buick slipstream and tumbled after it. Victoria McQueen was leaving, too. She went back into the house, but left the door open, and 3 minutes later she came out with her car keys in one hand and sacks for the grocery store in the other. Bing watched her until she was gone and then watched the street some more and finally let himself out. The sun had gone down, leaving an irradiated orange haze on the horizon. A few stars burned holes through the darkness above. "There was a gas-masked man, and he had a little gun," Bing sang to himself softly, what he did when he was nervous. "And his bullets were made of lead, lead, lead. He went to the brook and shot Vic McQueen right through the middle of her head, head, head." He walked up and down along the curb but could find only a single sheet of paper, crumpled and stained. Whatever he was expecting, it wasn't a photocopy of a news story about the man from Kentucky who had arrived at Bing's house 2 months ago in the Wraith, 2 days ahead of Mr. Manx himself. Mr. Manx had turned up, pale, starved-looking, bright-eyed, and bloody, in a Trans Am with zebra-print upholstery and a big silver hammer propped next to him on the passenger seat. By then, Bing already had the plates back on the Wraith, and NOS 4A2 was ready to roll. The Kentucky man, Nathan Demeter, had spent quite a while in the little basement room in the House of Sleep before going on his way. Bing preferred girls, but Nathan Demeter knew just what to do with his mouth, and by the time Bing was done with him, they'd had many long, meaningful, manly talks of love. It appalled Bing to see Nathan Demeter again in a photo accompanying an article titled "Boeing Engineer Vanishes." It made his tummy hurt. He could not for the life of him imagine why the junkie woman had come to Victoria McQueen with such a thing. "Oh, boy," Bing whispered, rocking. Automatically, he began to recite again. "There was a gas mask man, and he had a little gun, and his bullets were made of lead." "That's not how it goes," said a small, piping voice from behind him. Bing turned his head and saw a little blonde-headed girl on a pink bicycle with training wheels. She had drifted down from the barbecue at the end of the street. Adult laughter carried in the warm, humid evening. "My dad read me that one," she said. "There was a little man, and he had a little gun. He shoots a duck, right? Who is the gas mask man?" "Oh," Bing said to her. "He's nice. Everybody loves him." "Well, I don't love him."
"You would if you got to know him."
She shrugged, turned her bike in a wide circle, and started back down the street. Bing watched her go, then returned to the Dezotes, clutching the article about Demeter, which was printed on stationery from some library in Iowa. Bing was sitting in front of the TV with the Dezotes an hour later when Mr. Manx came out, fully dressed, in his silk shirt and tails and narrow-toed boots. His starved, cadaverous face had an unhealthy sheen to it in the flickering blue shadows. "Bing," Manx said, "I thought I told you to put Mr. and Mrs. Dezote in the spare room."
"Well," Bing said, "they aren't hurting anyone."
"No, of course they're not hurting anyone. They're dead. But that's no reason to have them underfoot either. For goodness sake, why are you sitting out here with them?" Bing stared for the longest time. Mr. Manx was the smartest, most observant, thinkingest person Bing had ever met, but sometimes he didn't understand the simplest things.
"Better than no company at all," he said.
Boston.
Lou and the kid had a room on the top floor of the Logan Airport Hilton. One night cost as much as Lou made in a week. Money he didn't have, but fuck it. That was the easiest kind to spend. And they weren't in bed that night until after Letterman. It was going on 1 a.m., and Lou thought for sure that Wayne had to be asleep, so he wasn't ready for it when the kid spoke up, voice loud in the darkness. He said just 9 words, but it was enough to make Lou's heart jump into his throat and jam there, like a mouthful of food that wouldn't go down. "This guy, Charlie Manx," Wayne said, "is he a big deal?" Lou thumped his fist between his big man boobs, and his heart dropped back where it belonged. Lou and his heart weren't on such great terms. His heart got so tired when he had to walk upstairs. He and Wayne had marched all over Harvard Square and the waterfront that evening, and twice he had needed to pause to get his wind back. He was telling himself that it was because he wasn't used to being at sea level, that his lungs and heart were adapted for the mountain air. But Lou was no dummy. He had not meant to get so fat. It had happened to his father, too. The guy spent the last 6 years of his life buzzing around the supermarket in one of those little golf carts for people who were too fat to stand. Lou would rather take a chainsaw to his layers of fat than climb into one of those fucking supermarket scooters. "Did Mom say something about him?" Lou asked. Wayne sighed and was briefly silent. Time enough for Lou to realize he had answered the kid's question without meaning to. "No," Wayne said at last.
"So where did you hear about him?" Lou asked.
"There was a woman at Mom's house today, Maggie someone. She wanted to talk about Charlie Manx, and Mom got really mad. I thought Mom was going to kick her ass."
"Oh," Lou said, wondering who Maggie someone had been and how she had gotten on Vic's case.
"He went to jail for killing a guy, didn't he?"
"This Maggie woman who came to see your mother, did she say Manx killed a guy?"
Wayne sighed again.
He rolled over in his bed to look at his father. His eyes glittered like ink spots in the dark.
"If I tell you how I know what Manx did, am I going to get in trouble?" he asked.
"Not with me," Lou said.
"Did you Google him or something?"
Wayne's eyes widened, and Lou could see he hadn't even thought of Googling Charlie Manx. He would now, though. Lou wanted to slam the heel of his hand into his forehead. "Way to go, Carmody. Way to fucking go. Fat and stupid."
"The woman left a folder with some newspaper articles in it. I kind of read them. I don't think Mom would have wanted me to. You aren't going to tell her, are you?"
"What articles?"
"About how he died."
Lou nodded.
Thought he was beginning to get it. Manx had died not 3 days after Vic's mother had passed away. Lou had heard about it the day it happened, on the radio. Vic had been out of rehab only 5 months and had spent the spring watching her mother waste away. And Lou had not wanted to say anything, was afraid that it would kick the legs out from under her. He had meant to tell her, but the opportunity never presented itself, and then, at a certain point, it became impossible to bring it up. He had waited too long. Maggie someone must have found out that Vic was the girl who got away from Charlie Manx, the only child to escape him. Maybe Maggie someone was a journalist. Maybe she was a true crime author working on a book. She had come by for a comment, and Vic had given her one, something definitely unprintable and probably gynecological. "Manx isn't worth thinking about. He doesn't have anything to do with us." "But why would someone want to talk to Mom about him?"
"You have to ask your mom on that one," he said. "I really shouldn't say anything. If I do, like, I'll be the one in trouble, you know?" Because this was the deal, his bargain with Victoria McQueen, the one they had settled on after she knew she was pregnant and decided she wanted to have the baby. She let Lou name the kid. She told Lou she'd live with him. She said she'd take care of the baby, and when the baby was sleeping, the two of them could have some fun. She said she would be a wife in all but name. But the boy was to know nothing of Charlie Manx, unless she decided to tell him. At the time Lou agreed, it all seemed reasonable enough. But he had not anticipated that this arrangement would prevent his son from knowing the single best thing about his own father. That his father had once reached past his fear for a moment of real Captain America heroism. He had pulled a beautiful girl onto the back of his motorcycle and raced her away from a monster. And when the monster caught up to them and set a man on fire, Lou had been the one to put out the flames. Admittedly too late to save a life. But his heart had been in the right place, and he had acted without any thought to the risk he was taking. Lou hated to think what his son knew about him instead. That he was a walking fat joke. That he made a mediocre living towing people out of snowbanks and repairing transmissions. That he had not been able to hold on to Vic. He wished he had another chance. He wished he could rescue someone else and Wayne could be watching. He would have been glad to use his big fat body to stop a bullet, as long as Wayne was there to bear witness to it. Then he could bleed out in a haze of glory. Was there any human urge more pitiful or more intense than wanting another chance at something? His son heaved a sigh, tossed himself onto his back.
"So, tell me about your summer," Lou asked. "What's the best part so far?"
"No one is in rehab," Wayne said. Beside the Bay. Lou was waiting for something to detonate. It was coming, any moment now. When Vic wandered over with her hands shoved down in that army jacket of hers and said, "This chair for me?" He glanced over at the woman who had never been his wife, but who had, incredibly, given him a child and made his life mean something. The idea that he had ever held her hand, or tasted her mouth, or made love to her, even now seemed as unlikely as being bitten by a radioactive spider. To be fair, she was certifiable. There was no telling who a schizophrenic would drop her pants for. Wayne was on the stone wall overlooking the harbor with some other kids. The entire hotel had turned out for the fireworks, and people were crammed onto the old red bricks facing the water and the Boston skyline. Some sat in wrought iron deck chairs, others drifted around with champagne and flutes. Kids ran around holding sparklers, drawing red scratches against the darkness. Vic watched her 12-year-old with a mix of affection and sad longing. Wayne hadn't noticed her yet, and she didn't go to him, did nothing to let him know she was there. "You're just in time for everything to go boom," Lou said. His motorcycle jacket was folded into the empty seat next to him. He grabbed it and put it over his knee, making room for her beside him. She smiled before she sat. That Vic smile, where only one corner of her mouth turned up, an expression that seemed somehow to suggest regret as much as happiness. "My father used to do this," she said. "Light the fireworks for 4th of July. He put on a good show. You ever think of making a day trip to Dover with Wayne to see him? That can't be more than an hour away from the lake." "I guess I'd get in touch with him if I needed to blow something up," she said. "If I needed some anfo." "Info?" "Anfo. It's an explosive. What my dad uses to take out stumps and boulders and bridges and so on. It's basically a big slippery bag of horseshit engineered to destroy things." "What is? Anfo? Or your dad?" "Both," she said. "I already know what you want to talk about." "Maybe I just wanted us to have 4th of July together as a family," Lou said. "Couldn't it be that? Did Wayne say something about the woman who turned up at the house yesterday?" "He asked me about Charlie Manx." "Shit. I sent him inside. I didn't think he could hear us talking." "Well, he caught a bunch of it."
"How much? Which parts?"
"This and that. Enough to be curious."
"Did you know that Manx was dead?" she asked.
Lou swiped damp palms on his cargo shorts. "Aw, dude. First you were in rehab, then your mom was dying. I didn't want to lay another thing on you. I was going to tell you at some point. Honestly, I don't like to stress you out. You know, no one wants you to go..."
His voice faltered and trailed off.
She gave him her lopsided smile again. "Batshit crazy?" He stared off through the dark at their son. Wayne had lit a new pair of sparklers. He waved his arms up and down, flapping his hands, while the sparklers burned and spit. He looked like Icarus just as everything began going wrong.
"I want things to be easy for you, so you can be around for Wayne. Not like I'm laying guilt," he added quickly. "I'm not giving you a hard time about having a hard time. Wayne and me have been doing okay, just the two of us. I make sure he brushes his teeth, gets his homework done. We go out on jobs together. I let him run the winch. He loves that. He's totally into winches and stuff. I just think he knows how to talk to you, or maybe you know how to listen, or something. It's a mom thing." He paused, then added, "I should have given you a heads up about Manx dying, though. Just so you knew there might be reporters coming around."
"Reporters?"
"Yeah, this lady who turned up yesterday. Wasn't she a reporter?"
They were sitting under a low tree, and there were pink blossoms in it. A few petals dropped, caught in Vic's hair. Lou ached with happiness, and never mind what they were talking about. It was July, and he was with Vic, and there were blossoms in her hair. It was romantic, like a song by Journey, one of the good ones.
"No," Vic said. "She was a crazy person."
"You mean someone from the hospital?" Lou asked.
Vic frowned, seemed to sense the petals in her hair, swiped a hand back, and brushed them away.
"So much for romance."
"She was, in truth, about as romantic as a box full of spark plugs." "You and me have never talked about Charlie Manx much," she said. "About how I wound up with him."
This conversation was headed in a direction he didn't like. They didn't talk about how she wound up with Charlie Manx, because Lou didn't want to hear about how the old fuck sexually assaulted her and kept her locked in the trunk of his car for 2 days. Serious conversations always gave Lou the stomach flutters. He preferred casual banter about the Green Lantern.
"I figured if you wanted to talk about it," he said, "you'd bring it up."
"I never talked about it because I don't know what happened."
"You mean you don't remember?"
"Yeah, yeah, I get that. I'd block that shit out, too."
"No," she said. "I mean, I don't know. I remember, but I don't know."
"But if you remember, then you know what happened. Aren't remembering and knowing the same thing?"
"Not if you remember it two different ways. In my head, there are two stories about what happened to me, and they both seem true. Do you want to hear them?"
"No, not at all." He nodded anyway.
"In one version, the version I told the federal prosecutor, I had a fight with my mom. I ran away. I wound up at a train station late at night.
I called my dad to see if I could stay with him, and he told me I had to go home. When I hung up, I felt a stinging in my backside. As I turned around, my vision blurred, and I fell into Manx's arms. Charlie Manx kept me in the trunk of his car all the way across the country. He only took me out to keep me drugged. I was aware vaguely that he had another child with him, a little boy, but he mostly kept us apart. When we got to Colorado, he left me in the trunk and went off to do something with the boy. I got out, forced the trunk open. I set fire to his place to distract him and ran to the highway. I ran through those awful woods with all the Christmas ornaments swinging from the trees. I ran to you, Lou. And you know the rest after that, she said. That's one way I remember things happening. Do you want to hear the other way? He wasn't sure he did, but nodded for her to go on. So, in a different version of my life, I had a bicycle. My father gave it to me when I was a little girl, and I could use this bicycle to find lost things. I would ride it across an imaginary covered bridge, and the bridge would always take me wherever I needed to go. Like once my mother lost a bracelet, and I rode my bike across this bridge and came out in New Hampshire, 40 miles away from home. And the bracelet was there, in a restaurant called Terry's Primo Subs. With me so far? Imaginary bridge, super-powered bike, got it. Over the years, I used my bicycle and the bridge to find all kinds of things. Missing stuffed animals or lost photos, things like that. I didn't go finding often, just once or twice a year. And as I got older, even less, it started to scare me because I knew it was impossible, that the world isn't supposed to work that way. When I was little, it was just pretend. But as I got older, it began to seem crazy. It began to frighten me.
I'm surprised you didn't use your special power to find someone who could tell you there was nothing wrong with you, Lou said.
Her eyes widened and lit with surprise, and Lou understood that in fact she had done just that. How did you? She began.
I read a lot of comics. It's the logical next step, Lou said. Discover magic ring, seek out the guardians of the universe. Standard operating procedure. Who was it?
The bridge took me to a librarian in Iowa.
Huh, it would be a librarian.
This girl, she wasn't much older than me, had a special power of her own. She could use Scrabble tiles to reveal secrets. Spell messages from the great beyond, that kind of thing.
An imaginary friend.
She gave him a small, scared, apologetic smile and a brief shake of the head. It didn't feel imaginary. Not ever. It felt real.
Even the part where you bicycled all the way to Iowa?
Across the shorter way bridge.
And how long did it take to get from Massachusetts to the corn capital of America?
I don't know. 30 seconds?
A minute, tops.
It took you 30 seconds to pedal from Massachusetts to Iowa, and that part didn't feel imaginary? No, I remember it all like it really happened.
Okay, gotcha. Go on.
So like I said, this girl in Iowa, she had a bag of Scrabble tiles. She could pull letters out and line them up into messages. Her Scrabble letters helped her unlock secrets in the same way my bicycle could help me find lost objects. She told me there were other people like us, people who could do impossible things if they had the right vehicle. She told me about Charlie Manx. She warned me about him. She said there was a man, a bad man with a bad car. He used his car to suck the life out of children. He was a kind of vampire, a road vampire.
You're saying you knew about Charlie Manx before he ever kidnapped you?
No, I'm not. Because in this version of my life, he didn't kidnap me at all. In this version of my life, I had a dumb fight with my mom, and then after, I used my bicycle to go looking for him. I wanted to find some trouble, and I did. I crossed the shorter way bridge and came out at Charlie Manx's sleigh house. He did his best to kill me, but I got away from him and ran and met you. And the story I told the police, all that stuff about being locked in his trunk and being assaulted, that was just something I made up, because I knew no one would believe the truth. I could tell any story I wanted about Charlie Manx, because I knew that stuff he had really done was worse than any lie I could make up. Remember, in this version of my life, he's not a dirty old kidnapper. He's a fucking vampire. She was not crying, but her eyes were wet and shiny, luminous in a way that made Fourth of July sparklers look chintzy and dull.
"So he sucked the life out of little kids," Lou said. "And then what? What happened to him?"
"They went to a place called Christmasland. I don't know where that is. I'm not sure it's even in our world. But they get great phone service, because the kids there used to call me all the time." She looked out at the children standing on the stone wall, Wayne among them, and whispered, "They were ruined by the time Max drained the life out of them. Nothing left in them but hate and teeth." Lou shuddered.
"Jesus."
A small knot of men and women erupted into laughter nearby, and Lou glared at them. It didn't feel as if any people in their general vicinity had any right to be enjoying themselves at this particular moment. He looked at her and said, "So to recap, there's one version of your life where Charlie Manx, a dirty old fucking child murderer, kidnapped you from a train station, and you only barely got away from him. That's the official memory. But then there's this other version where you crossed an imaginary bridge on a psychically powered bicycle and tracked him down in Colorado all on your own. And that's the unofficial memory, the VH1 behind the music story."
"Yes.
And both of these memories feel true to you."
"Yes.
But you know," Lou said, eyeing her intently, "that the story about the shorter way bridge is bullshit. Deep down, you know it's a story you told yourself, so you don't have to think about what really happened to you, so you don't have to think about being kidnapped and all the rest of it."
"That's right," Vic said. "That's what I figured out in the mental hospital. My story about the magic bridge is a classic empowerment fantasy. I couldn't bear the thought of being a victim, so I invented this vast illusion to make me the hero of the story, complete with a whole set of memories of things that never happened."
He sat back in his chair, his motorcycle jacket folded over one knee, and relaxed, breathed deep. "Well, that wasn't so bad." He understood now what she was saying to him, that she had been through something awful, and it made her a crazy person for a while. She had retreated into fantasy for a time. Anyone would. But now she was ready to put the fantasy away, to deal with things as they were.
"Oh," Lou added, almost as an afterthought. "Shit. This kind of got away from what we were talking about. What does all this have to do with the woman who came to your house yesterday?"
"That's Maggie Lee," Vic said.
"Maggie Lee? Who the hell's that?"
"The librarian. The girl I met in Iowa when I was 13. She tracked me down in Haverhill to tell me that Charlie Manx is back from the dead and coming after me." Lou's big, round, bristly face was almost comically easy to read. His eyes didn't just widen when Vic told him she'd met a woman from her own imagination. They popped, making him resemble a character in a comic strip who has just had a swig from a bottle marked XXX. If there had been smoke jetting from his ears, the picture would have been complete. Vic had always liked to touch his face, and could only barely resist doing it now. It was as inviting as a rubber ball is to a child. She had been a child the first time she kissed him. They both had been, really.
"Dude, what the fuck? I thought you said the librarian was make-believe, like your covered bridge of the mind."
"Yep, that's what I decided in the hospital, that all those memories were imagined, an elaborate story I'd invented to protect myself from the truth."
"But she can't be imaginary. She was at the house. Wayne saw her. She left a folder behind. That's where Wayne read about Charlie Manx," Lou said.
Then his big, expressive face came alive with a look of dismay.
"Aw, dude, I wasn't supposed to tell you that. About the folder."
"Wayne looked in it?"
"Shit. I told her to take it with her. I didn't want Wayne to see it."
"You can't let him know I told you." Lou made a fist and wrapped it on one of his elephantine knees.
"I am so shitty at keeping secrets."
"You're guileless, Lou. That's one of the reasons I love you." He lifted his head and gave her a wondering stare.
"I do, you know," she said. "It's not your fault I made such a rotten mess of everything. It's not your fault I'm such a colossal fuck-up."
Lou bowed his head and considered this. "Aren't you going to tell me I'm not so bad?" she asked.
No. I was thinking how every man loves a hot girl with a history of making mistakes, because it's always possible she'll make one with you.
She smiled, reached across the space between them, put her hand on his. I have a long history of making mistakes, Louis Carmody, but you weren't one of them. Oh, Lou, I get so fucking tired of being in my own head. The screw-ups are bad and the excuses are worse.
That's what both versions of my life have in common, you know. The one thing. In the first version of my life, I'm a walking disaster because Mommy didn't hug me enough and Daddy didn't teach me how to fly kites or something. In the other version, I'm permitted to be a crazy fucking mess. Stop. And ruin your life and Wayne's life. Stop kicking yourself. Because all those trips through the shorter way bridge messed me up somehow. Because it was an unsafe structure to begin with, and every time I went across it, it took a little more wear. Because it's a bridge, but it's also the inside of my own head.
I don't expect that to make sense. I hardly understand it myself. It's pretty Freudian in there.
Freudian or not, you talk about it like it's real, Lou said. He looked out into the night. He took a slow, deep, steadying breath. So is it? Yes, Vic thought with a wrenching urgency.
No, she said.
It can't be. I need it not to be. Lou, do you remember that guy who shot the congresswoman in Arizona? Loeffner? He thought the government was trying to enslave humanity by controlling grammar. To him, there was no question it was happening. The proof was all around him. When he looked out the window and saw someone walking the dog, he was sure it was a spy, someone the CIA had sent to monitor him. Schizos invent memories all the time, meeting famous people, abductions, heroic triumphs. That's the nature of delusion. Your chemistry fouls up your whole sense of reality. That night I stuck all our phones in the oven and burned our house down. I was sure dead children were calling from Christmas land. I heard the phones ringing even though no one else did. I heard voices no one else heard. But Vic, Maggie Lee was at your house. The librarian. You didn't imagine that. Wayne saw her, too.
Vic struggled for a smile she didn't really feel.
Okay, I'll try and explain how it's possible. It's simpler than you think. There's nothing magic about it. So, I have these memories of the shorter way bridge and the bike that took me finding. Only they aren't memories. They're delusions, right? And in the hospital, we had group sessions where we'd sit and talk about our crazy ideas. Lots of patients in that hospital heard my story about Charlie Manx and the shorter way bridge. I think Maggie Lee is one of them, one of the other crazies. She latched onto my fantasy and made it her own. What do you mean you think she was one of the other patients? Was she in your group sessions or not? I have no memory of her in those sessions. What I remember is meeting Maggie in a small-town library in Iowa. But that's how delusion works. I'm always remembering things. Vic lifted her fingers and made imaginary quotation marks in the air to indicate the essentially untrustworthy nature of such recollections. These memories just come to me all at once. Perfect little chapters in this crazy story I wrote in my imagination. But of course there's nothing true about them. They're invented on the spot. My imagination provides them, and some part of me decides to accept them as fact the instant they come to me. Maggie Lee told me I met her when I was a child, and my delusion instantly provided a story to back her up. Lou, I can even remember the fish tank in her office. It had one big koi in it, and instead of rocks, it had Scrabble tiles on the floor. Think about how crazy that sounds! I thought you were on medicine. I thought you were okay now. The pills I take are a paperweight. All they do is pin the fantasies down. But they're still there. And any strong wind that comes along, I can feel them rattling around, trying to slip free. She met his gaze and said, Lou, you can trust me. I'm going to take care of myself. Not just for me. For Wayne. I'm all right. She did not say she had run out of Abilify a week earlier, had to spread the last few pills out so she didn't come down with withdrawal. She didn't want to worry him any more than necessary, and besides, she planned to refill her prescription first thing next morning. I'll tell you something else. I don't remember meeting Maggie Lee in the hospital, but I easily could have. They had me pumped so full of drugs in there I could have met Barack Obama and I wouldn't remember it. And Maggie Lee, God bless her, is a lunatic. I knew it the moment I saw her.
She smelled like homeless shelters, and her arms were scarred from where she'd been shooting junk or burning herself with cigarettes, or both, probably both.
Lou sat next to her, head lowered, frowning in thought. What if she comes back? Wayne was pretty freaked.
We're headed to New Hampshire tomorrow. I don't think she's going to find us up there.
You could come to Colorado. You wouldn't have to stay with me. We wouldn't have to stay together. I'm not asking for anything, but we could find you a place where you could work on search engine. The kid could spend the days with me and the nights with you. We got trees and water in Colorado, too, you know.
She sat back in her chair. The sky was low and smoky, the clouds reflecting the lights of the city so that they glowed a dull, dirty shade of pink. In the mountains above Gun Barrel, where Wayne had been conceived, the sky was filled to its depths with stars at night, more stars than you could ever hope to see from sea level. Other worlds were up in those mountains, other roads.
I think I'd like that, Lou, she said.
He'll go back to Colorado in September to go to school, and I'll come with him, if it's all right.
Of course it's all right. Are you out of your mind?
For a single instant, long enough for another blossom to fall into her hair, neither of them spoke. Then, at a shared glance, they burst into laughter.
Vic laughed so hard, so freely, she had to gasp to get enough air into her lungs.
Sorry, Lou said. Probably not the best choice of words.
Wayne, 20 feet away, turned on the stone wall to peer back at them. He held a single dead sparkler in one hand. A ribbon of black smoke drifted from it. He waved.
You go back to Colorado and find me a place, Vic said to Lou.
She waved back at Wayne. And at the end of August, Wayne will fly back, and I'll be with him. I'd come right now, but we've got the cottage on the lake until the end of August, and he's still got 3 more weeks of day camp paid for.
And you've got to finish working on the motorcycle, Lou said.
Wayne told you about that?
Didn't just tell me. He sent me pictures from his phone. Here.
Lou tossed her his jacket. The motorcycle jacket was a big, heavy thing, made of some kind of black nylon-like synthetic, and with bony plates sewn into it, Teflon armor. She had thought it was the coolest jacket in the world from the first time she put her arms around it, 16 years before. The front flaps were covered in faded, frayed patches. Route 66, Seoul, a Captain America shield. It smelled like Lou, like home. Trees and sweat and grease and the clean, sweet winds that whistled through the mountain passes.
Maybe this will keep you from getting killed, Lou said. Wear it.
And at that moment, the sky above the harbor pulsed with a deep red flash. A rocket detonated in an eardrum-stunning clap. The skies opened and rained white sparks. The barrage began.
I-95 24 hours later, Vic drove Wayne and Hooper back to Lake Winnipesaukee. It rained the whole way, a hard summer downpour that rattled on the road and forced her to keep to under 50 miles an hour. She was across the border and into New Hampshire when she realized she had forgotten to refill her prescription for Abilify. It required all her concentration to see the road in front of her and stay in her lane. But even if she had been checking the rearview mirror, she would not have noticed the car following at a distance of 200 yards. At night, one set of headlights looks much like any other. Lake Winnipesaukee. Wayne woke in his mother's bed before he was ready. Something had jolted him out of sleep, but he didn't know what until it came again, a soft thump, thump, thump at the bedroom door. His eyes were open, but he didn't feel awake. A state of mind that would persist throughout the day, so that the things he saw and heard had the talismanic quality of things seen and heard in a dream. Everything that happened seemed hyper-real and freighted with secret meaning. He did not remember going to sleep in his mother's bed, but was not surprised to find himself there. She often moved him to her own bed after he nodded off. He accepted that his company was sometimes necessary, like an extra blanket on a cold night. She was not in bed with him now. She almost always rose before him. Hello, he said, knuckling his eyes. The knocking stopped, then started again in a halting, almost questioning way.
Thud, thud, thud.
Who is that? Wayne asked.
The knocking stopped. The bedroom door creaked open a few inches. A shadow rose upon the wall, the profile of a man. Wayne could see the big bent crag of a nose and the high, smooth Sherlock Holmes curve of Charlie Manx's forehead. He tried to scream. He tried to shout his mother's name. But the only sound he was able to produce was a funny wheeze, a kind of rattle, like a broken sprocket spinning uselessly in some tired machine. In the mugshot, Charles Manx had been staring straight into the camera, his eyes bulging, his crooked upper teeth pressed into his lower lip to give him a look of dim-witted bafflement. Wayne couldn't know him by his profile, and yet he recognized his shadow in a glance. The door inched inward. The thump, thump, thump came again. Wayne struggled to breathe. He wanted to say something. "Please, help!" But the sight of that shadow held him silent, like a hand clamped over his mouth. Wayne shut his eyes, snatched a desperate breath of air, and shouted, "Go away!" He heard the door ease inward, whining on its hinges. A hand pressed heavily on the edge of the bed, right by his knee. Wayne forced out a thin, whinnying cry, almost inaudible. He opened his eyes and looked, and it was Hooper. The big, pale dog stared urgently into Wayne's face, forepaws on the bed. His damp gaze was unhappy, even stricken. Wayne looked past him at the partly open door, but the Manx shadow wasn't there anymore. On some level, Wayne understood it had never been there, that his imagination had stitched together a Manx shape out of meaningless shadow. Another part of him was sure he had seen it, a profile so clear it might have been inked on the wall. The door was open wide enough so Wayne could see into the corridor that ran the length of the house. No one was there. Yet he was sure he had heard a knock, could not have imagined that. And as he stared down the hall, it came again. Thump, thump. And he looked around and saw Hooper beating his short, thick tail against the floor. "Hey, boy," Wayne said, digging into the soft down behind Hooper's ears. "You scared me, you know. What brings you?" Hooper continued to gaze up at him. If someone had asked Wayne to describe the expression on Hooper's big, ugly face, Wayne would have said it looked like he was trying to say he was sorry, but he was probably hungry. "I'll get you something to eat. Is that what you want?" Hooper made a noise, a wheezy, gasping sound of refusal, the sound of a toothless gear spinning uselessly, unable to engage. Only, no. Wayne had heard that sound before, a few moments ago. He had thought he himself was making it, but the sound wasn't coming from him, and it wasn't coming from Hooper. It was outside, somewhere in the early morning dark. And still Hooper stared into Wayne's face, his eyes pleading and miserable. "So sorry," Hooper told him with his eyes. "I wanted to be a good dog. I wanted to be your good dog." Wayne heard this thought in his head, as if Hooper were saying it to him, like a talking dog in a comic strip. Wayne pushed Hooper aside, got up, and looked out the window into the front yard. It was so dark he could at first see nothing except his own faint reflection on the glass. And then the Cyclops opened one dim eye, right on the other side of the window, 6 feet away. The blood surged to Wayne's heart, and for the second time in the space of 3 minutes, he felt a yell rise into his throat. The eye opened, slow and wide, as if the Cyclops were just rousing itself. It glowed a dirty hue located somewhere between orange tang and urine. Then, before Wayne could produce a cry, it began to fade, until there was only a burning copper iris glimmering in the darkness. A moment later, it went out completely. Wayne exhaled unsteadily. A headlight. It was the headlight on the front of the motorcycle. His mother rose from beside the bike and swiped her hair back from her face. Seen through the old rippled glass, she didn't seem to really be there, was a ghost of herself. She wore a white halter top and old cotton shorts and her tattoos. It was impossible to make out the details of those tattoos in the dark. It looked as if the night itself were adhering to her skin. But then Wayne had always known that his mother was bound to some private darkness. Hooper was out there with her, whisking around her legs, water dripping off his fur. He had obviously just come from the lake. It took Wayne a moment to register that Hooper was beside her, which didn't make sense, because Hooper was standing beside him. Except that when Wayne looked around, he saw he was alone. He didn't think about it long. He was still too tired. Maybe he'd been awoken by a dream dog. Maybe he was going crazy like his mother. Wayne pulled on a pair of cutoffs and went out into the pre-dawn cool. His mother worked on the bike, rag in one hand and a funny tool in the other, that special wrench that looked more like a hook or a curved dagger. "How'd I get in your bed?" he asked. "Bad dream," she said. "I don't remember having a bad dream." "You weren't the one having it," she said. Dark birds dashed through the mist that crawled across the surface of the lake. "You find the busted sprocket?" Wayne asked. "How do you know it's got a busted sprocket?" "I don't know, just from how it sounded when you tried to turn it over." "You've been spending time out in the garage, working with your dad?" "Sometimes. He says I'm useful because I have little hands. I can reach in and unscrew things he can't get to. I'm great at taking stuff apart. Not so good at putting stuff together."
"Join the club," she said. They worked on the bike.
Wayne was not sure how long they were at it, only that by the time they quit it was hot and the sun was well up above the tree line. They hardly spoke in all the time they worked. That was okay. There was no reason to ruin the greasy, knuckle-scraping effort of fixing the bike with a lot of talk about feelings or dad or girls. At some point, Wayne sat back on his heels and looked at his mother. She had grease up to her elbows and on her nose, was bleeding from scrapes on her right hand. Wayne was running steel wool over the rust-flecked tailpipe, and he paused to look at himself. He was as filthy as she was.
"I don't know how we're going to get this crap off us," he said. "We got a lake," she said, tossing her hair and gesturing toward it with her head. "Tell you what, if you beat me to the float, we can have breakfast at Greenbow Diner." "What do you get if you beat me?"
The pleasure of proving that the old woman can still thrash a little piker.
"What's a piker?" "It's a..."
But he was off and running, grabbing his shirt, snapping it off over his head, flinging it in Hooper's face. Wayne's legs and arms pumped fast and smooth, bare feet slashing through the burning bright dew in the high grass. Then she was sailing past him, sticking her tongue out as she reached his side. They hit the dock at the same time. Their bare feet smacked on the boards. Halfway to the end, she reached out and put her hand on Wayne's shoulder and shoved, and he heard her laughing at him as he lurched drunkenly off balance, his arms peddling in the air. He hit the water and sank into murky green. He heard the low, deep bloosh of her diving off the end of the dock a moment later. He flailed, came up spitting and hauling ass for the float, 20 feet offshore. It was a big platform of splintery gray boards, floating on rusty oil drums. The thing looked like an environmental hazard. Hooper woofed furiously from the dock behind them. Hooper disapproved of merrymaking in general, unless he was the one making it. Wayne was most of the way to the float when he realized he was alone in the lake. The water was a black sheet of glass. His mother was nowhere to be seen, anywhere, in any direction.
"Mom," he called.
Not afraid.
"Mom!"
"You lose," she said, her voice deep, hollow, echoing. He dived, held his breath, paddled underwater, came up under the float. She was there, in the darkness, her face glistening with water, her hair shining. She grinned at him when he came up beside her. "Look," she said, "lost treasure." She pointed at a trembling spider web, at least 2 feet wide, decorated with 1,000 gleaming beads of silver and opal and diamond.
"Can we still go to breakfast?"
"Yeah," she said. "Got to. Victory over a piker is a lot of things, but it isn't very filling." Gravel driveway. His mother worked on the bike all afternoon. The sky was the color of a migraine. Thunder sounded once. It was a boom and bang, like a heavy truck going over an iron bridge. Wayne waited for rain. None came.
"Did you ever wish you had adopted a Harley Davidson instead of having a kid?" he asked her.
"Would have been cheaper to feed," she said. "Hand me that rag." He handed it to her. She wiped her hands and fitted the leather seat over a brand new battery and threw her leg over the saddle. in her cut-off jeans and oversized black motorcycle boots, tattoos scrawled on her arms and legs, she looked like no one anyone would call Mom. She turned the key and hit the run switch. The Cyclops opened its eye. She put one heel on the kickstart, lifted herself up, slammed her weight down. The bike wheezed. "Gesundheit," Wayne said. Vic rose and came down hard again. The engine exhaled, blew dust and leaves out the pipes. Wayne didn't like the way she threw all her weight down on the kickstart. He was afraid something would shatter, not necessarily the bike. "Come on," she said in a low voice. "We both know why the kid found you, so let's get on with it." She hit the kickstart again, and then again, and her hair fell into her face. The starter rattled, and the engine produced a faint, brief, rumbling fart. "It's okay if it doesn't work," Wayne said. Suddenly he didn't like any of this. Suddenly it seemed like crazy business, the sort of crazy business he had not seen from his mom since he was a small boy. "Get it later, right?" She ignored him. She raised herself up and set her boots squarely on the kickstart. "Let's go find you, bitch," she said, and stomped. "Talk to me." The engine ba-boomed. Dirty blue smoke shot from the pipes. Wayne almost fell off the fence post he was sitting on. Hooper ducked, then barked in fright. His mother gave it throttle, and the engine roared. It was frightening, the noise of it. Exciting, too. "It runs," he hollered. She nodded. "What's it saying?" he yelled. She frowned at him. "You told it to talk to you. What's it saying? I don't speak motorcycle language." "Oh," she said. "Hi-yo, Silver." "Let me get my helmet," Wayne yelled. "You're not coming." Each of them screaming to be heard over the sound of the engine battering the air. "Why not?" "It's not safe yet. I'm not going far. Be back in 5 minutes." "Wait!" Wayne shouted and held up one finger, then turned and ran for the house. The sun was a cold white point, shining through the low piles of clouds. She wanted to move. The need to be on the road was a kind of maddening itch, as hard to leave alone as a mosquito bite. She wanted to get on the highway, see what she could make the bike do, what she could find. The front door slapped shut. Her son came charging back, carrying a helmet and loose jacket. "Come back alive, right?" he called. "That's the plan," she said. And then as she was putting the jacket on, she said, "I will be right back. Don't worry." He nodded. The world vibrated around her from the force of the engine. The trees, the road, the sky, the house, all of it shuddering furiously, in danger of shattering. She had already turned the bike to face the road. She punched the helmet down onto her head. She wore the jacket open. Right before she let the handbrake out, her son bent down in front of the bike and snatched something out of the dirt. "What?" she asked. He handed it to her, that wrench that looked like a curved knife, the word Triumph stamped into it. She nodded thanks and pushed it down into the pocket of her shorts. "Come back," he said. "Be here when I do," she said. Then she put her feet up, dropped it into first, and she was gliding. The moment she started moving, everything stopped shaking. The split-tie fence slid away on her right. She leaned as she turned onto the road, and it felt like an airplane banking. It didn't feel as if she were touching the blacktop at all. She shifted into second. The house dropped away behind her. She cast a last glance over her shoulder. Wayne stood in the driveway, waving. Hooper was out on the street, gazing after her with a curiously hopeless stare. Vic gave it throttle and shifted into third, and the Triumph lunged, and she had to squeeze the handlebars to keep from falling off. A thought flashed through her mind, the memory of a biker t-shirt she had owned for a while. "If you can read this, the bitch fell off the back." Her jacket was unzipped, and it scooped up the air and ballooned around her. She rushed on into low fog. She did not see a pair of close-set headlights come on down the road behind her, glowing dimly in the mist. Neither did Wayne. Route 3. Trees and houses and yards flashed by, dark, blurred shapes, only dimly apprehended in the mist. There was no thought in her. The bike rushed her away from thought. She had known that it would, had known the first moment she saw it in the carriage house that it was fast enough and powerful enough to race her away from the worst part of herself, the part that tried to make sense of things. She triggered the gear shift with her foot again and then again, and the Triumph jumped forward each time, swallowing the road beneath it. The fog thickened against her, blowing into her face. It was pearly, evanescent, the sunlight striking through from somewhere up and to the left, causing the whole world to glow around her, as if irradiated. Vic felt that a person could not hope for more beauty in this world. The damp road hissed like static under the tires. A gentle, almost delicate ache caressed her left eyeball. She saw a barn in the shifting mist, a long, tall, tilted, narrow structure. A trick of the billowing vapor made it appear to be sitting in the middle of the road, not 100 yards away, although she knew that the highway would hook off to the left in another moment and swing her past it. She half-smiled at how much it looked like her old imaginary bridge. Vic lowered her head and listened to the susurration of the tires on wet asphalt, that sound that was so like white noise on the radio. What were you listening to when you tuned to static, she wondered. She thought she had read somewhere that it was the background radiation in which the entire universe bathed. She waited for the road to hook left and bring her around the barn, but it kept on straight. That tall, dark, angular shape rose before her until she was in its shadow. And it wasn't a barn at all, and she only realized that the road ran straight into it when it was too late to turn aside. The mist darkened and went cold as a dip in the lake. Boards slammed under the tires, a rapid-fire knocking sound. The mist was snatched away as the bike carried her up and out of it and into the bridge. She sucked at the air and smelled the stink of bats. She drove her heel down on the brake and shut her eyes. This isn't real, she thought, almost whispered to herself. The foot pedal for the brake went all the way down, held for a moment, and then came completely off. It fell onto the boards with a deep, hollow thud. A nut and a collection of washers went jingling after it. The cable that carried the brake fluid flapped against her leg, spurting. The heel of her boot touched the worn boards beneath her, and it was like putting her toe into some 19th-century threshing machine. A part of her insisted she was hallucinating. Another part felt her boot striking against the bridge and understood that her hallucination would snap her in two if she dumped the bike. She had time to look down and back, trying to process what was happening. A gasket spun through the air from somewhere, carving a whimsical arc through the shadows. The front tire wobbled. The world slurved around her, the black tire skidding out and around, slamming madly across loose boards. She lifted herself up from the seat and slung her weight hard to the left, holding the bike up more by will than by strength. It slid sideways, rattling across the boards. The tires grabbed at last, and the bike came to a shuddering stop and immediately almost fell over. She got a foot down first, held it up, although only barely, gritting her teeth and struggling against the sudden weight. Vic's breathing echoed raggedly in the barn-like interior of the shorter way bridge, unchanged in the 16 years since she had last seen it. She shivered, clammy in her bulky motorcycle jacket. "Not real," she said, and shut her eyes. She heard the gentle, dry rustling of the bats overhead. "Not real," she said. White noise hissed softly, just on the other side of the walls. Vic concentrated on her own breath, inhaling slowly and steadily, then exhaling again through pursed lips. She stepped off the bike and stood beside it, holding it up by the handlebars. She opened her eyes but kept her gaze pointed at her feet. She saw the boards, old, grayish-brown, worn. She saw flickering static between the planks. "Not real," she said for a third time. She closed her eyes again. She wheeled the bike around to face back the way she had come. Vic began to walk. She felt the boards sink under her feet, under the weight of the little Triumph Bonneville. Her lungs were tight, and it was hard to draw a full breath, and she felt sick. She was going to have to go back to the mental hospital. She was not going to get to be Wayne's mother after all. At this thought, she felt her throat constrict with grief. "This is not real. There is no bridge. I am off my meds and seeing things. That's all.
She took one step, and another step, and another, and then opened her eyes again, and was standing with her broken motorcycle in the road. When she turned her head and looked back over her shoulder, she saw only highway. The Lake House.